Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Member SIPC. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
The Prime Minister, Theresa May, is about to trigger Article 50. We have polling that suggests that more than half of the British population support her, that believe that she is doing a good job. Are you not worried that, from your point of view at least, the train has now left the station?
Yeah, of course. We're very anxious about this. But the truth is that we haven't yet seen what the real terms of our departure are. We don't really know yet what Brexit means. We have taken the decision over the past few months, which wasn't clear, by the way, at the time of the Brexit vote, that we're going to leave the single market, the customs union. About two-thirds of our trade will now, the arrangements will have to be renegotiated. Actually, the amount of immigration we're going to stop is probably around 12% of the total we will have control over. Most of that immigration is not really immigration that's going to impact the people of the country. So, you know, yes, of course, what the government want to say is the train's left the station. There's no way it's ever going to be derailed. We've just got to go ahead. But my view is that once people see the pain-gain ratio in reality, not claim and counterclaim, but facts, then I think they may well change their mind.
Do you think facts are going to change people's minds? This was an emotional decision in many ways by the British people.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think you're right that the emotions were a very strong part of it. But, you know, if people, for example, think the government is so obsessed with Brexit that it so dominates everything, they're not dealing with our healthcare problems, our unemployment problems, social care, rising crime, you know, then I think people will start to say, well, hang on a minute, actually, we want a government focused on those things.
Mr. Prime Minister, good morning. I was quite taken by the emotion of your speech and your bluntness and directness. Our global audience knows the Labour Party of Blair, of Gordon Brown, of Alistair Darling, etc., and now it's become a jumble. Who did you speak for today? You didn't speak for today's Labour Party, did you?
Well, parts of it probably, but not its leadership, no. But I think, you see, this thing with Brexit is part of a much, much bigger debate. It's really about globalization. It's about what I would call the open-minded approach to the world versus the closed-minded. Now, the reality is that that distinction goes across traditional boundaries of left and right. And so, you know, I think, in a way, what I was articulating was a feeling and a sense that some people in the Conservative Party will agree with, people in the Liberal Democrats, and some people in Labour. It's not really a sort of partisan position, but I think it's a position that has a lot of support, particularly amongst younger people.
What is the middle ground that Prime Minister May must move to? Identify the compromises or the most important compromises that you would suggest the Prime Minister should make.
I think the key thing is that we retain the ability to trade in an easy way with our main trading partners. And we certainly maintain close links around issues like defense, security, the environment, and so on. The problem, though, and this is the problem, to be fair to the Prime Minister, she faces, and she's, you know, this is not an easy task. And I'm, at one level, deeply sympathetic to her about it. But the problem is there are no easy ways of maintaining all those links whilst doing what the people on the right, who are really driving this agenda, the far right, want. So if, for example, you don't want people from Europe to come here or you want big restrictions on them, it's very hard to reconcile that with membership of the single market. You see what I mean? So I think the problem is I can say what I think she should do from the perspective of what would be in the interest of the country, but I'm not sure it's negotiable given the red lines she set herself.
How does change get affected here? I'm curious to see how you think the mechanism will work. parliamentarians have largely backed the Prime Minister. They have made it very clear that they feel, whether or not they think she's on the right course, that they will back her. Will the House of Lords, are you arguing that the House of Lords should step in? Are you calling for another referendum? You've argued against kind of governing by referendum in the past. What exactly are you arguing for in here in terms of the process?
Yeah, so this is a really important point. Right now, there is no way that the many millions of people who feel that this decision is wrong and who particularly now think we are going down the route of Brexit at any cost, right? There is no way they can articulate their feelings. So what I'm saying is all these different groups in different political parties who are agitating around this issue are saying, come on, let's actually think what we're doing here, that we've got to combine together. And then, frankly, members of Parliament who at the moment feel, look, OK, this is just going to happen, so what's the point of me speaking out against it? You've got to give them the strength, the courage, the protection, if you like, to be able to say, well, hang on, my constituents are now saying to me, we need certain guarantees about this, or my constituents are now saying to me, we don't like the way this is turning out.
Are you suggesting they coalesce around you? Are you the right person for this? And if so, if you're not, who is?
Well, I don't know that you... I don't think you need a person. I think you need a movement. I think you need... I mean, the one advantage...
Somebody's got to start this.
Well, I think there are lots of people already starting it. The question is really how you coordinate it, and that's for the different leaders of the different groups to come together and different people in different political parties to come together. But it's not... You know, one advantage of today's politics is that it does change fast. So I just think, you know, right now we need to be making the arguments, getting out to people the facts, and then tracking very carefully this negotiation. Remember, we haven't yet begun the process of negotiation. Yep. So we don't know what terms we're being offered. Once we know, we've surely got a right to say we like it or we don't like it.
Prime Minister, on this show the other day, Deutsche Bank suggested that we would see a substantially weaker pound sterling, that we would see a depreciation in pound sterling given Brexit and given the path of the United Kingdom economy. How much depreciation in sterling can all of the United Kingdom take?
Well, that is a very good question, and it goes directly to what I'm saying because, you know, I don't think people expected this, who voted for Brexit really expected a large fall in sterling. I don't think they quite appreciated this was the financial market's future, you know, prediction, as it were, that as to the course of the British economy. And already some of the imported foodstuffs and the things that people rely on in the shops has started to go up. So our inflation rate is going up. That's a classic example of where, as the pain of this becomes clear, people are going to say, OK, so let's go back and ask why we really did this. And I think when you do that, you go back to certain things and certain problems when you analyze it, Brexit isn't really going to affect those things. So this is a very good example of exactly what I'm saying.
Mr. Prime Minister, I have to ask a delicate question, and it has to do with a firestorm in Washington at this time. It is presumed that the President will visit Prime Minister May. Should he be allowed to speak and to enter Westminster Hall at your House of Commons?
Well, whether he enters Westminster Hall and addresses the House of Parliament, that's a matter for Parliament, and I won't comment on it. But of course he will come here and look, whatever the situation is, the British-American relationship is important. I certainly am not criticizing the Prime Minister for reaching out to President Trump. It's important that she builds a strong relationship. And frankly, right now, I've got enough on my hands without entering into your political debate.
Final question. We sit here in the City of London. How should the financial services sector be protected in this whole process? And again, the debate in the last few days about Vauxhall and its future and what could happen there and the deal that was given to Nissan. How can individual parts of the British economy be protected? Should individual parts be protected or should actually be a level playing field?
Well, I think for the financial sector, it's such a huge part of our economy. We've got to make sure the arrangements are satisfactory. But you see, there again, I think it's hard to do that. You know, you can move to sort of equivalence arrangements, but that doesn't really deal with the problems the financial sector has. And again, my worry is that the financial sector, unless it's given some fairly clear guarantees soon, will start to make decisions in advance of what the final outcome is of the negotiation. So we have to see.
Joining us now is Howard Ward. He is Chief Investment Officer of Growth Equities at Gabelli Funds. And let me just pick up by talking a little bit about growth with you, Howard. You said the longer-term outlook for growth has brightened in a recent note. What's your outlook? We still hear talk of reaching 4% growth. Any likelihood of that happening as you see it?
David, I think 4% is going to be a stretch. And this just gets back to the mathematics of growth, yeah, which is a function of the productivity per worker, and productivity growth is anemic right now, and the growth in the labor force. And growth in the labor force is about 1%. You can have people working longer hours. That's not going to get you very far. So when you combine anemic productivity growth with a very slow growth labor force, getting to 4% is a stretch. Frankly, David, getting to 3% for more than a couple quarters is going to be a stretch.
What did you hear from the Fed Chair Janet Yellen this week when she was testifying on Capitol Hill? How much does the economy she wants to see mirror what we're seeing in the U.S. economy right now?
Well, that's a really good question. I happen to have tremendous respect for Janet Yellen. I think the Federal Reserve Board, however, has a history of being late to the game when it comes to executing monetary policy. And if you'll recall, we went into 2016 with the Fed telegraphing four interest rate hikes. They did one, and that was in December. The previous year, they did one. That was in December. And during the course of 2016, following that 2015 increase in rates, we hit a record low on 10-year treasuries of about 135 last summer. Now, part of that had to do with, of course, the Brexit vote, which created a downward shift in interest rates. But I think the Fed talking about raising rates three times this year is way optimistic. We've raised rates twice in the last 10 years. Are we going to do it three times this year? I don't think so. Not when the personal consumption expenditure deflators 1.7% year over year. The Fed's target is 2%. It's not there yet. We're looking at GDP growth this year of 2 to 2.5%. Certainly not a runaway economy. We're looking at corporate profit growth. It's going to be single digits, I think, at best. And retail sales, I think, are going to be flagging. I think a lot of the economic data is about to roll over. I think the January data was helped by seasonal adjustments, which will not be so kind over the next couple of months. So I'm concerned the Fed is setting policy based on lagging and coincident indicators, and they're not focusing enough on the 100 plus basis point increase in interest rates, the 80 basis point increase in mortgage rates, the 7% increase in the dollar, the 35% increase in fuel prices over the last 12 months.
We got to come back and talk about that, because that was a real backstory to the conversation yesterday with the vice chairman. David Gurin talking. David, together.
Together. Again. Here we are.
We missed you. We went to the Trump Hotel just to make an appearance.
Yes.
We'll save that for another time. Howard, what you're talking about is the markets, I guess, helping the Fed to a more restrictive policy. How many rate increases is the equivalency of all that you just said? Has Stanley Fisher and Janet Yellen been given the next rate increase by market adjustment?
I think that there's a lot of momentum towards the next rate increase. And again, that's based on the current data, which I believe is about to roll over. And even if you look at oil prices right now, technically they're looking a little top heavy, as if maybe they're rolling over. When you look at interest rates, we hit 260 in mid-December. We're close to 240 now. Maybe rates are rolling over. I think that that the Fed is late, and I think that they need to be more focused on the tightening in financial conditions. What I didn't mention is banks are becoming more restrictive in their lending policies, and that's a factor. The tremendous policy uncertainty coming from the Trump administration is another thing that they should be thinking about. Trade is already being hurt, I believe, even though there's been no trade changes yet in policy. That's coming, and it's already causing some changes in behavior, not for the better, I might add. So I think that the Fed is being overly influenced by the data that's hot off the press and by the market. And I think they need to take a step back and take in the whole of the U.S. economy. We really don't have an inflation problem. We're still below the Fed's target. We don't have runaway growth. We do have wage increases, which I know they're focused on because Yellen's a labor economist.
Help the dumbest person listening or doing this. That would be me. Horse and cart. Is the Fed the cart or the horse about the wage dynamic, either nominal wage growth or rising inflation, real wage growth? Who gets to be the horse?
Well, that's a good question. Tom, I'm not sure I even know the answer to that. I think...
Wait, that's really important because the books that... Professor Ward is correct. Professor Orfanides would say, we don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, that's tough. It happens, but we're not sure exactly how it's transmitted. So, but we do know that there is upward pressure on wages. We do know the unemployment rate's as low as it's been in quite
Howard,
some time.
They gotta wait.
Yeah.
You're the money pro here. They gotta wait.
Yeah, I think if the Fed, for example, comments, I think, was it Rosenkranz?
Rosenkranz of Boston.
Right. I think he suggested this week that he sees at least three increases this year. I think that's completely crazy.
On this Friday, whether it was Lou Rukeyser and Frank Capiello, Lou Rukeyser and Howard Ward, nothing's changed from talking to Lou a million years ago. The central bank has to wait.
Yes.
Am I right?
Yeah, I think that the central bank should not be so anxious to normalize rates. I think it's time to take a timeout and let's see what happens.
Okay.
Particularly with the new administration.
We have Howard Ward with us, truly one of the world's great multinational large cap investors, and just a perfect time to speak to him about the mating of Kraft and Unilever. Of course, we're not there yet with the mating, the proposal turned down by Unilever. Howard, a compare and contrast. You know, $122 billion in market cap, $106 billion market cap, revenue $59 billion. Kraft is a lot smaller company, $26 billion. But to me, it's about profitability. Kraft, I got a 30 cents on the dollar EBITDA margin, and Unilever, a lot more diffuse. I've got an 18 cents dollar. What is this about? Is it about the synergy game? You mate two dinosaurs, mate. You don't own either stock, and you just do synergies to affect a better margin?
Yeah, Tom, I think scale is ever more important in this world. And, perhaps the one take advantage of these low rates while we have them, perhaps want to take advantage of the sell-off and the pound sterling in the wake of Brexit. We are looking at a group of stocks, this sector of stocks, consumer packaged goods stocks, which are really selling at the highest multiples they've ever sold at. You're paying about 20 times forward earnings for Unilever, where you have top-line growth of low single digits. That's pretty fully priced. The EBITDA multiple on the price today would be about 13 times forward EBITDA. These are not bargain basement prices, but rates are so low, and you're not earning anything on cash. So maybe it does make some sense to combine and cut costs.
Exactly, to cut costs. This is something Sir Martin Sorrell talked about, the canonel of expense reduction. In low nominal GDP, as you mentioned on the break, very small revenue growth, which we've seen across, maybe Nestle's yesterday, with the same idea. 42,000 employees at Kraft Heinz, 171,000 at Unilever, was just at a body count, gives them lots of room to do the dreaded synergy work. Do you and Mario Gabelli like synergy deals? Do they work out?
Well, I think like with most acquisitions, the report card on that is mixed. So often what happens when large companies combine, so often there are cultural issues which sometimes hinder the advancement of revenues and profits, and things don't work out the way they originally hoped. But of course, that's not always the case, and these are good operators. I'm a little bit perplexed, though, Tom, because the Brazilians that control Kraft Heinz were on the news wires yesterday being quoted as saying they were no longer going to pursue another consumer packaged good acquisition. So perhaps that story was not, maybe that was fake news.
Do you think that was fake
news?
Go.
Alternative facts.
Alternative facts.
Should we have a press conference?
We'll call it now. Reading from the statement here from Kraft Heinz, it says, Kraft confirms it's made a comprehensive proposal to Unilever about combining the two groups to create a leading consumer goods company with a mission of long-term growth and sustainable living. What does that last phrase mean to you there, Howard? Long-term growth and sustainable
living. You got Howard Ward going. He's over here. It's a mission, Howard.
This is, you know, this is... Kraft Heinz, Unilever, these are companies that tend to grow in line with nominal GDP. So, growth is a relative measure. And again, in a slow growth world, if you are trying to advance the ball and you have a currency that's cheap and you're concerned about rising inflation and the erosion of the purchasing power, maybe this is the kind of investment, but this is not, there's no cheap deal here.
Okay, but is this the price of the great distortion? Bill Gross talks about financial repression and the oddity of where yields are. The price is big dinosaurs are they have to mate.
Right. So, Tom, what do companies do with their cash flow, dividends, share buybacks, acquisitions or investment, in this case, looks like acquisition, and then cut. The only way this really is going to make sense,
exactly,
I think, is to do to take the knife to the costs and do that. I think that they may be they're good at that. What can I say? They're very good operators.
I mean, I agree with that. But to Sir Martin Sorrell's comment about this is the culture of the moment, is this within your investment purview, well, is this forever?
Hold on. Sir Martin Sorrell's been doing this for 20, 30 years.
Yeah, but is this forever? The cost cutting is the mantra given tepid nominal GDP.
Yeah.
I agree.
I mean, this is what companies do to create growth when growth is not easily had.
Invent growth,
right,
almost.
Right. You have to acquire and cut. You've got to go to the alchemist and do it.
Thank you. You've been an alchemist today, and thank you so much. Howard Ward, driving forward the fake news at Bloomberg Surveillance. With Gabelli Funds, I'm Matt. Howard, thank you so much. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC. David, what a week. And it is wonderful on a Friday to speak to our next guest.
Yeah, Barry Eichengreen, of course, the Party Professor of Economics and Political Science at UC Berkeley, teaching a course with Brad DeLong on Introduction to Economic History this semester. It's joining us from Germany, of all places, today. He wrote a great piece for Bloomberg View just a couple of days ago called Don't Sell the Euro Short. It's here to stay. And let's start there, if we could. Professor Eichengreen, give us a sense of the sentiment there in Europe. So much of your column, so much of your piece for Bloomberg View centers on this notion that we could see a dissolution of changes to the euro. What does sentiment say when you're there in Germany? Are people talking about that?
There is a lot of chatter in not only in Germany, but in Italy, where I was previously, about whether there's an easy way for southern European countries to back out of the euro. So there's chatter from France about a dual exchange rate. There's chatter from Italy about whether a new lira and the euro could circulate side by side. So I read these as speculations about whether the mother of all financial crises problem that would develop if a country announced the intention of withdrawing the euro could be finessed. And my view continues to be no.
You write that skeptics have been predicting the demise of the euro continuously since its creation in 1999. Is this time at all different, or do you see this as part of that continuum of people predicting it and not coming to pass?
I think it'll be another episode like the previous episodes in the end, but the worrisome development is that public support for the euro is declining in countries like Italy. I don't think Mrs. Le Pen and Madame Le Pen in France is the major problem here because of the scenario in which the other mainstream parties coalesce against her in the second round. But it's really public support that is the constraint and the worry. And in places like Italy, you see that beginning to dissipate.
There isn't a treasury, of course, no European treasury. It seems like this project is a bit inchoate, a bit incomplete. Do you ever anticipate we will see the euro fully realized here, the eurozone fully realized, or are we always looking back here and not looking forward?
It depends how long we live.
Yeah.
I don't think it'll be fully realized anytime soon. Monetary union needs banking union, fiscal union, and political union to really function smoothly as it does to a first approximation in the United States. They're moving pretty rapidly now to banking union after 20 years, 25 years after Maastricht, where they did not yet want to go down the banking union road. So 25 years, and they've achieved one of the three necessary steps. It'll take, who knows, 25 more years to get the fiscal union and something resembling the political union, if that.
Professor Eichengreen, good morning. I want to talk about Vice Chairman Fischer and the Fed here in our next section. But to keep it to Europe now, we had the privilege of a conversation with Prime Minister Blair this morning. And I dovetailed into the conversation Deutsche Bank and HSBC's call for a dramatically weaker sterling to move from 140 down to 124, with Deutsche Bank calling 105, 108, given political upheaval. What happens to a nation, a developed economy nation, not a banana republic, when they enjoy that much devaluation?
I'm not sure enjoy would be the right word, but there's already a lot of complaining about how the price of Marmite has gone up as a result of sterling's decline. The cost of living goes up. Those vacations in the south of Spain become more expensive. That's what currency fluctuations do. There's still the bigger worry about what happens to the service sector in the UK, what happens to the city. And I'm not optimistic, given sterling's decline has been one of the factors that has prevented the realization of a big economic slowdown, of a major recession in the UK. But I think that eventually will be the unavoidable fallout of Brexit.
One of the things that Prime Minister Blair said in that interview today was that ahead of that vote, people weren't aware that sterling might or would decline in the way that it did. When you look back at what was predicted and what has come to pass here, how right were those who were predicting what was going to happen?
There's a furious debate about that in the UK at the moment. Did the experts get it right? Did they get it wrong? Well, as usual, the experts got it half right. I think the experts were, including me, were expecting a weaker sterling and a weaker UK economy. So we've gotten the first so far, and we're waiting on the second. I had been predicting a weaker UK economy. I'm going to be keep predicting it as it were until I'm right.
We're heading into we've had the G20. We're heading into a weekend with the Munich Security Conference, and it strikes me that there still is interest, at least in Europe, in sort of a cohesion in the spirit of security, unity for security. Is that what's going to preserve the euro in the near term? Do you think that sense that they're all in it together?
I think that's a major factor. Think back to the creation of the European community. It was all about security. It was all about making Europe safe from internal warfare and from external threats, you know, keeping the Germans down, keeping the Soviets out, keeping the Americans in. That's what people said about NATO, but they also said it about the European community. I think it is viewed as even more important in Europe now that the United States is no longer a reliable ally.
I mean, this goes back to your book, The European Economy, since 1945. What is, if you were to rewrite that book today, I can't believe, Barry, it's 8 years old already. It seems like it came out yesterday. If you were to rewrite that today, what about the European economy since 2016? I mean, we're living history right now. What will that volume look like in 5 years?
One of the themes of that volume was how Europe had a set of institutions and social arrangements, strong trade unions and employers' associations that would work together with government that could deliver reasonable economic growth, but also equitable growth. And that was an advantage that the European economies needed to build on. Those institutions are now under tremendous strain. So if I were to write a second edition of that book, I would have to wait and see whether European societies succeed in updating those institutions for the 21st century, or whether they disintegrate.
We've been remarkably free this week of discussion on China. Barry, give us an update on the U.S.-China relationship. You had a book a year or two ago where you were Exorbitant Privilege, I believe it was, and you were adamant that China would not dominate. Do you still hold that to be true?
China has plenty on its own plate. So if you think about currency competition between the dollar and the renminbi, people are now realizing that there are both financial reasons and political reasons why the renminbi has a long way to go, has to run for decades before it becomes a meaningful rival to the dollar in the international sphere. And I think similarly, in terms of the Chinese economy and China's geopolitical ambitions, that they have financial imbalances, they have a gradually decelerating economy, they have plenty on their plate domestically that will hamper them a bit, at least in the international sphere.
David, I put out on Twitter three or four books of Barry Eichengreen's. That should keep everybody busy.
There you go, just a small sampling of the oeuvre there.
The royalty check I got, it's enough to put a kid through Stanford.
Barry Eichengreen with us, the Party Professor of Economics and Political Science at UC Berkeley, joining us on the Spectrum Enterprise phone line. Spectrum Enterprise, nationwide fiber-based network and IT infrastructure solutions. I don't know if you had a chance, Professor Eichengreen, to see Tom's interview yesterday with Vice Chairman Stanley Fisher, but what struck Carl Riccadonna, our chief U.S. economist, as well was how confident he was, how proud he was of the calls the Fed had made, especially when it comes to wage growth. He said that it started happening. It's not far off from what the Fed thought it would be. Give us a sense of how the Fed is maybe regarding itself vis-a-vis that interview yesterday.
Well, I think that's right. The Fed is getting inflation up to target, and if we have productivity growth, that means wages have to rise faster than headline inflation. So all of that is of a piece, and I think the Fed is on track there. A major danger, Tom alluded to that before the break, is the dollar. It may be up by 7% or so since the election, but there is a scenario where it rises a whole lot more as a result of the policies yet to come.
A question about sort of how the Fed views the economy right now versus how the economy is. In other words, is the economy we're seeing in the U.S. close to in line with what the Fed wants to see?
Yeah, I think they're pretty much on target. They think we're not too far from full employment. They don't believe that the participation rate is going to come zooming back to 1990s levels. Mm. They see inflation about where it belongs. So I think they're pretty happy with where we're now, and they're pretty alarmed about where we could go in the future.
Do you do joint lectures with Brad DeLong?
They teach a class together.
I think you're barely on speaking terms, but do you both get in a room together?
We have been known to get in a room together, but it's more Socratic, if you will.
Yeah.
Typically, one of us will stand in the front and the other one will sit in the back, and then we'll address questions to one another in the
just
same
heckle,
way.
Just heckle from the back of the lecture.
I'm in row 14, right. And I nodded off asleep because I was drinking all night. And so you wake me up, and then I ask you or Brad DeLong this question, and I think it's important. Given all that you know, can markets adjust and preclude rate increases? If the dollar goes up, if interest rates move, if the slope of the yield curve changes, this, that, the other thing, does that help a Fed not raise rates, or do they just ignore all that?
They do not ignore it. So if the dollar really zooms up at this point because it's being pushed up by the change in the monetary fiscal policy mix, it's being pushed up by the adoption of a border adjustment tax. It's being pushed up by new import restrictions that Mr. Trump imposes on Mexico and China. A much stronger dollar could be a significant headwind to growth, and the Fed could stop in its tracks, or at least it could end up raising rates considerably fewer than the three times that the markets are now counting on.
How much uncertainty is allayed by having Steven Mnuchin in the job of Treasury Secretary? Right now, we have the G20 meeting underway in Europe as we speak, and I know that there's been some worry among G20 members. They haven't had a figurehead, a person to air grievances with here in the U.S. while he's been absent. How big a deal is it to have him in place?
sure would be nice to be a fly on the wall for those discussions. I think what everybody is going to ask the Treasury Secretary is, who does Mr. Trump really listen to on economic policy? Does he listen to Gary Cohn? Does he listen to Peter Navarro? Which set of advice, given that he's going to be confronted by different kinds of recommendations coming from very different kinds of economists, who is he going to respond to? We outsiders at this point, the markets at this point, have absolutely no idea.
Barry Eichengreen, thank you so much. Generous of you to be with us the last number of weeks. He is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. If you want one accessible book of the many accessible books of Professor Eichengreen, folks, it was my book. I believe it was a book of the year. It may have been book of the summer a couple years ago. Exorbitant Privilege is short, sharp, and focused. Can't say enough about it, but he is just always art writing. Wonderful to have him on Dollar and International Economics. Let me get your attention. The University of Pennsylvania, in an adult study, calls the Munich Security Conference the best think tank conference. That's high words. It's where everybody in the racket gets together, including James Stavridis of the Fletcher School, Tufts University, here on really a meeting and mating of all in international relations. Admiral, we could talk to you this morning for an extended press conference. We could go and go and go.
Should we keep going?
We will not do that. Let me start first with this conference. What do you try to accomplish in Munich?
I think it is your listeners, many of whom are in the financial world, will relate to it if I called it the Davos of security. Huh. It brings together everybody who is focused on global security, and I think people want to get three things out of it, just like at Davos, which you know quite well, Tom. They want to network. They want to connect with other decision makers, so foreign ministers, ministers of defense, heads of state. Secondly, everybody here wants to move their message and agenda from Russia and China to the United States and the European Union in public settings. And then thirdly, you want to listen. You want to hear what others are saying, particularly those with whom you disagree. So it's a very robust setting for all three of those.
David wants to dive into that. Let me ask you one question. We were noting earlier the terrorist attack in Pakistan, and then hours later, another substantial attack in Baghdad. We in the media are guilty of not covering these terror attacks while we look at horrific events, say, in Paris or London or where, you know, wherever in America, full front and center. How do we balance that? What is your counsel to us paying more attention to third world terror?
I think the way to do it best, Tom, is to put it in a global context. And you mentioned the Paris terror attacks last Christmas. Almost at the same moment, a marketplace in Lebanon blew up, killing even more people than died in Paris. So those two events need to be covered side by side, not in isolation, and described for what they are. In the case of the two I just mentioned, Islamic State activity. So taking things that are happening in, if you will, smaller media markets, but putting them in the global context is something the media can do very effectively.
You had the defense secretary in Brussels over the weekend. The G20 meeting was underway this week. Then there's the Munich Security Conference, as you just mentioned, taking place this weekend. The vice president just boarding his plane at Joint Base Andrews to head over to Munich for that. This is a real debut for the Trump administration on the international stage this week. What are you expecting to hear from the vice president in Munich when he speaks?
I'll tell you what I'm hoping to hear, and I suspect I will hear, is first of all that there will be continued support for NATO, that it's not obsolete, as the president said at one point, but in fact it's very important, which the president also said at another time. So hopefully the vice president will clarify that it's the former and not the latter. Secondly, he will put heat on the Europeans to raise their defense spending to the 2% of GDP goal, and that's a good thing. And thirdly, the vice president, who's a very steady personality, I think will be endeavoring to show people that kind of balance and purpose and perhaps counterweight some of what's coming out of Washington itself these days, unfortunately.
What did you make of the speech that Defense Secretary Mattis delivered in Brussels? He spoke about that 2% threshold you were talking about there. Was it a forceful speech? Was it a speech that might take some allies off guard? What did you make of what he had to say and how he said it?
I think it was the speech everyone expected. General Mattis is a former senior NATO official. He has great sympathy, empathy, and understanding of the organization. But he did put the allies on notice that if the United States does not see a rise in European defense spending, there'll be less commitment to the alliance. Mm-hmm. I interpreted that as fewer forward deployments, potentially pulling more troops out of Europe. I think the Europeans will wake up to that and realize they need to move out.
Help me with the subtleties of getting to this weekend. We observed the Prime Minister of Japan and the President at the Winter White House dealing with a Korean missile launch right on cue. How aware are we of any Russian actions into the weekend? Do they want to force the dialogue given the disarray in Washington?
Tom, I don't think so in the case of this particular conference. The Munich Security Conference has historically, and this is my 12th, 15th time here perhaps, has historically been a place where the Russians want to come and lay out their case. We often see Foreign Minister Lavrov here, who's an excellent English speaker, laying out Russian position. So I think this is a weekend where you won't see Russian provocation. But let's face it, there's been plenty of it in the lead up to this. It's kind of overhanging the conference. But I don't think you'll see it this particular weekend, Tom.
James Stavridis of Tufts University and their Fletcher School. Admiral Stavridis, let me read a tweet to you. I know you've been waiting for this. From the president, General Keith Kellogg, who I have known for a long time, is very much in play for NSA, as are three others. With great respect, Admiral, have you been contacted by the White House?
I have not been contacted directly. I've received some low-level inquiries, and I've made it clear that I am quite content continuing outside the government at this point. And, Tom, you know, I'll continue to do a lot of commentary. As a former NATO Supreme Allied Commander, I'm available to give advice and so forth. But I don't know where they go from here. I think they were very disappointed when Vice Admiral Bob Harward chose not to come into government, citing personal reasons. And the only other name I've heard consistently is that of General Dave Petraeus, but I think that's problematic because General Petraeus was convicted of lying, and so you kind of fire someone for lying, and then you bring someone else in convicted of it. It's a kind of hard sell.
Within your experience, and given the turmoil, does an NSA leader demand that they bring in their own people, or do they slot in with existing and newer personnel selected by, oh, say, Mr. Bannon or, for that matter, the president?
I think at this point, given the level of controversy and turmoil, a new national security advisor would be well advised to go into it saying, I need to bring in my team, people that I know, that I can trust, that I have built relationships with. Now, that's not every spot, but it's certainly a group of at least a dozen or so who would sit astride the National Security Council staff. I think going in just by yourself as a firefighter surrounded by what appear to be a lot of ideologues at this point would be a mistake for almost anybody.
You know, I'd heard ahead of that meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu that General Michael Flynn had done a lot of the groundwork before that meeting in Washington, D.C. I imagine he'd done a lot of legwork ahead of the Munich Security Conference as well. How big a void is that for this administration, not having a permanent head, permanent national security advisor in place going into a big forum like the one that you're at in Munich?
Oh, it's a huge void. And historically, the national security advisor comes to this event, looms very large. It's also worth remembering that the deputy national security advisor, KT McFarland, was not elevated when General Flynn was fired, but instead they reached down to the chief of staff. That really undercuts her authority and influence. And there have been media reports that she's leaving. She says the president said she could stay. I think she's problematic in that regard. So really no one's steering the ship from the White House in terms of national security. And at a meeting like this, that absence is felt.
Just the last question here about the press conference yesterday. The president did touch upon foreign policy. He talked about how eager he was to have a massive rebuilding of the United States military. He said they don't have the right equipment. It's old. I wonder just about the veracity of that. When you look at how well-equipped the U.S. military is right now, is there credence to what he said yesterday? If that's a keystone policy point for him, is it rooted in truth? Is this a military that is not equipped properly?
This is a military that currently receives $600 billion a year in spending for defense, and we are well-equipped in a lot of areas. There are some areas where the inventory, the platforms, the ships and the planes, some of the ground vehicles are aging, and many have been through tough combat over 10 years in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I would say there's some level of rebuilding to do, but no one should doubt the capability of the U.S. military, which is a quantum leap ahead of any other competitor in the world.
All right. Thanks very much, Admiral James Stavridis there, Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC.